Now we're taking another look at the Russian invasion in Ukraine. Russian troops appear to be moving eastward within the country after being pushed out of the capital region and areas in the north. There are growing concerns about war crimes with attacks on hospitals and schools, and there appears to be evidence in Bucha of a wave of execution-style killings. Meanwhile, President Zelensky is asking the United States for more support, requesting military aid, and asking Western countries to invoke stronger sanctions against Russia. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the U.S. is doing enough to support Ukraine? Should the U.S. send over more weapons? Are we already doing too much, do you think? What questions do you have about what's going on in Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a political scientist and professor at UW-Madison. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Russian forces apparently have been pushed, or at least withdrawn, away from Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. They're headed eastward to the area where Russia was already declaring those parts independent. What have you been watching for in those particular developments over the last week?
Well, unfortunately, what the world has seen is that the pullout of Russian troops has left a wake of civilian casualties that many people are talking about in terms of war crimes and just atrocities that are hard to stomach. So on the one hand, the pullout is good. It means Ukraine has recaptured territory north of its capital. But I think many people expect that this doesn't mean necessarily a reduction in the war effort by Russia, but a reconfiguration and a stronger push in the south and the east.
I want to talk about what Russia is hoping to get out of this. There was an editorial that's gotten a lot of attention in a state-run Russian news outlet titled "What Russia Must Do with Ukraine." Here's some quotes from it in translation. "Denazification must be de-Ukrainization. Ukraine may not exist as a national state. Any attempt to create it leads to Nazism." Another quote, "Elites must be liquidated. They cannot be re-educated. The social swamp who supported them must experience terror of war and learn the lesson and pay for its guilt." That, in addition to the war crimes you mentioned, that seems like a state-approved justification for war crimes. What do you make of that and other statements from Russian media and leaders?
Yeah, well, it is really important to watch what they are saying. That is pretty clearly a sort of genocidal statement. That denies the right of Ukraine to exist as a state and actually calls for punishing civilians in Ukraine. So it's a very dangerous statement. And we know that the media in Russia is at this point totally controlled by the government. So there has to be some level of approval. On the other hand, I think one of the things to note is that the Russian government has tried out different rationales for explaining this war to its population, including claiming that they were winning, that there's very few casualties, that everything's going fine. I think it's going to be harder and harder for the government to claim that there's no casualties, that there's no losses, and they're going to have to explain why so much damage is being inflicted on Ukraine. So I think this is an attempt for another step in this denazification rationale, which is a absurd claim that Ukraine has been taken over by Nazis and they need to be stopped. So it's a very serious statement, but I think it is also a sign of desperation on the part of the government in order to come up with a rationale for its war losses.
Russia, there were some leaked documents early on that suggested that Russia thought within a few days this war would have been over. They would have been in control of Ukraine and controlling the destiny of the country. That clearly didn't happen. What, to the extent that we can understand it, what is the Russian goal now? Are they hoping to still control all of Ukraine, to destroy Ukraine, to control parts of it? I can't puzzle it out.
Yeah, I don't think they are capable of, quote, winning at this point. I think that they are capable of inflicting much more damage and causing many more civilian casualties. So that's the scary part that I think of. But in terms of what their goals were, remember initially the idea behind it, to the extent there was a rational plan, was to recognize the independence of those two regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, in the east. And supposedly they were going there to help Russian citizens, Russian ethnic Russians living in those areas. And instead of just focusing on those areas, they moved towards Kiev and towards a larger invasion. So that led a lot of people to think that what they were trying to do was to take over the whole government, replace the Zelensky government with a sort of puppet government. And I think they were delusional enough to think that that would actually work. And delusional, I say, because they don't recognize the resolve and the commitment to a Ukrainian nation that we're seeing throughout Ukraine. So I think they initially thought it would be easy. They could just replace the government. It would be very simple. But they are not finding many collaborators. The Zelensky government did not fold, and the Ukrainian army has been tougher and more resilient than many people thought they would be. So at this point, what is their plan? Possibly to capture the south and east so that they have a connection between Crimea and those two areas of the Donbass that they want. But I don't know at this point that they're even going to be successful in that more limited goal.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera, political scientist, specialist in Russian and post-Soviet states at UW-Madison, looking at the latest news in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I want to give a listen to Ukrainian President Zelensky making a pre-recorded speech at the Grammys over the weekend. Here's a listen.
We defend our freedom to live, to love, to sound. On our land, we are fighting Russia, which brings horrible silence with its bombs, the death silence. Feel the silence with your music. Feel it today to tell our story.
President Zelensky calling on the music community there, but also calling for more support from the U.S. and the Western world. What tools are still in the toolkit for the U.S. and Europe when it comes to supporting Ukraine?
Well, there's, I think, two really important directions. One is further military aid to Ukraine. I think that that's going on, and I think there's discussions now, especially in light of the atrocities that we saw over the weekend, in terms of doing more. So I think there's more, there are options for more military aid, and that I think is first and foremost, because I don't think Putin is going to stop until he is stopped militarily. Second is the sanctions, and there are there's a range of additional sanctions that can still be put in place, including additional financial sanctions, additional secondary sanctions, but most importantly is the cutting off of revenue to the Russian government through cutting energy exports, primarily from Europe. So that's, I think, the big discussion going on now is how can Europe find a way to reduce 30% of its energy supply rather quickly. And I guess I would say for our American audience, in terms of what we can do, the U.S. is the largest producer of oil and gas, but we're also the largest consumer. And so when we want to support Ukraine, I think one of the things that we have to think about is how might we shift some of our consumption and exports to Europe to make up for some of the gap from Russia. So I think there's a lot of things that could be done, maybe not immediately, but there are ways to move away from buying Russian oil and gas. And that's going to be the key in reducing income for the Putin government.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Hi. I don't think that America has much credibility to deal with the situation over there. We've invaded, I don't know, maybe a dozen countries in the last 10 years. Probably 50 countries, at least before that point in time. But I think right from the beginning that they should have been like France, because anyone that knows anything about military stuff, Ukraine is not going to win. At least with France, when the Germans came in, they knew their country was going to be destroyed. So they let them come in and they worked from the inside. At least they still had a country intact. This country is going to look like Syria. Every building, actually, it won't be that bad, but it'll be bad enough. The country is partially destroyed already.
Dan, thanks for the call. Dan says, I guess Ukraine should have let the invasion roll in. I mean, I think Russia has demonstrated a willingness to kill people under areas that they control with or without military resistance.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that that perspective definitely has its supporters, even in U.S. government. I mean, there are some people who think Ukraine should have just accepted as a fait accompli a Russian invasion. But yeah, the big worry is what we see under areas that were under Russia control is these mass killings of civilians and atrocities. And so that should give anybody pause about saying, well, if Ukrainians had just gone along with it, everything would have been fine. So I think that's probably not what would have happened if Ukraine had just surrendered immediately. But the other thing I think that's really important in this conflict is the moral clarity and the willingness of Ukrainians to fight in this case. Ukrainians are doing all the fighting. They're asking for weapons and supplies from NATO countries. And so it's a bit different from Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq in the sense of there isn't a complex situation of who might be in charge, who to support, which group wants what. There was a democratically elected government in place that's still in place. And so what to do in this case is not actually that complicated. And I think that's one of the reasons there's so much unity and support for Ukraine is because it's such a simple, wrong situation in terms of the Russian invasion.
Yoshiko Herrera stays with us, political scientist, professor at UW-Madison, expert on Russia and post-Soviet states, giving an update on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the U.S. do? What do you want to see the U.S. not do when it comes to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with political scientist Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, looking at Russia's invasion in Ukraine and the U.S. and Western response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the U.S. role in Ukraine so far? Should we be doing more, doing less? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko, weapons, humanitarian aid, assent from the U.S. and Western Europe, very much reluctance to do things like no-fly zones or anything that might lead to, in effect, you Americans and Russians shooting at each other. Could you talk about that reluctance?
Yeah, the reluctance is that Russia is a nuclear power. The United States, NATO have nuclear weapons. And so the big danger is that an escalation into a direct conflict between NATO and Russia could lead to a nuclear exchange. That's the big danger. On the other hand, the other side of things is to sit back and watch these mass atrocities and war crimes. And so that's the dilemma. There are no good answers here. I think so we can't say if somebody wants a no-fly zone. No-fly zone means shooting down Russian planes. Mm-hmm. It means shooting down, shooting areas that supply planes, airports, et cetera, within Russia. So no-fly zone, to some extent, to the extent it's enforced, actually means engagement between NATO and Russia. And so that's the reluctance on the no-fly zone per se. But I think the examples from the Cold War, where there were proxy wars, where we had the same dilemma, is that we should expect NATO in this case to do everything it can short of a formal engagement with Russia. So that's where I think there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes and the supporting Ukraine militarily. It's right for Ukrainians to keep pushing for more, but I think a lot of that is happening sort of behind the scenes. And the main reason for that is to avoid a direct confrontation, which could be very dangerous.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question. This would be much further down the road, but I wondered, would there ever be an opportunity for Ukraine to seek reparations from Russia for an unprovoked attack?
Tom, that's a great question. Morally, Yoshiko, it seems like, of course. Practically, it seems unlikely.
Yeah, it's very hard to say, especially if Russia is kicked out of various European institutions, which might be the place for adjudicating claims like that. So, yes, I agree with you completely that morally, yes, practically, it's not clear. On the other hand, all this seizure of Russian assets abroad, it's not clear what's going to happen to those assets, but I could see that there may be a case to be made for using those towards reparations or rebuilding Ukraine.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine with Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison. Still time for your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Yoshiko, I want to look at the view inside Russia now. I know public opinion in an authoritarian country is hard to gauge. The closest thing to independent surveys, though, seem to show a lot of support for Vladimir Putin since the invasion and support for the invasion yourself. How much can we know about that?
I think that what we know is there are a lot of people in Russia who support Putin, and that support for Putin translates into support for the role for the war. But we also know that there is a lot of discontent and there are a lot of people who don't support Putin. However, in the repressive context that we have now in Russia, where Putin has really cracked down on people, I mean, he is arresting young people for posts on social media from five years ago at this point. He's arresting high school students who posted parts of the Russian Constitution in their newspaper. I mean, he's really cracked down on people. And so people are not answering surveys in droves because it's just simply not worth the risk. So I think knowing the precise level of support for Putin versus for the war versus against him and against the war, it's very hard to say right now. And I would not take those surveys to be very meaningful. I don't think they tell us whether support for the war has gone up or not, or whether support for Putin has gone up or not because of the repressive context that's been instituted since the war started.
Right. If I were in Russia, I might be very reluctant to tell even an independent pollster, yeah, no, I don't like Putin, and assume that that would stay confidential.
Right. There's absolutely no incentive to do that. I mean, if you were going to wage a protest against the regime, that seems like not something I would risk it for. As a social scientist, I hate to say that, but I'm not sure a supposedly anonymous survey is what people are going to risk punishment for.
Where does this end up? How can there be any kind of negotiated settlement when at least part of the philosophy of the invading nation is that the invaded nation doesn't actually exist and the people don't exist as a separate entity?
Yeah, I think that at this point, unfortunately, Putin is going to stop when he is stopped militarily. So I don't really see anything other than a military defeat stopping him at this point. The sanctions are important because they weaken the state capacity in Russia and they weaken his ability to wage war. But they're not going to convince him that he's done something wrong because he simply doesn't care. So I think that that's why I think there has to be a strategy of both supporting Ukraine militarily and keeping up with the sanctions in order to weaken the government. In terms of Putin's survival within Russia, I think that hinges on whether he can convince people that the destruction of the economy and the destruction that is happening in Ukraine is not his fault. And I think that's a tall order. And I think we can see from the censorship, the repression, et cetera, that their strategy of normal media control isn't working very well. But I think whether he's able to deflect blame is going to determine the survival of his regime. But in terms of the war stopping, I think that is unfortunately going to be up to the Ukrainians.
Time for one more caller. Gary is with us in Kaukauna. Gary, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Hey, I got a couple of things. One is that I believe that we keep hearing all these sanctions that have been imposed over the last 9 months or whatever. You know, I haven't seen the scorecard on that. What's worked? What hasn't worked? How many sanctions we have left and what's left in the quiver, so to speak?
Gotcha. I'm going to leave you there, Gary, because you don't have a ton of time left. Yoshiko, what do we know about the sanctions, especially the ones imposed in the last couple of months, how they've worked and how much we have left in the tank to do more?
Yeah, well, so it's only been 40 days, really, since they've been imposed. I think the sanctions so far are unprecedented in scale, scope, and speed I think a lot of experts on a scale of 1 to 10 would say we're at a 7 or an 8. So there is more to do, and more to do primarily focuses on cutting the energy exports and secondary sanctions, secondary financial sanctions. So there is more that can be done. And I would not be surprised this week if we see more of that happening in light of what happened over the weekend.
And in our last minute or so, Yoshiko, you mentioned earlier Russia potentially being removed from important world bodies. I think the UN Human Rights Commission may be kicking off the Russian representative. Ukraine calling for Russia to be booted from the UN Security Council, taking away their veto. How significant would that be?
Well, it would be significant, but the UN moves very slowly. Mm-hmm. So I think the kicking them off the Human Rights Council is kind of a symbolic measure. It doesn't mean a lot. If they were to be removed from the Security Council, that would be a whole reshaping of the UN architecture. But I expect that would take a long time, and I wouldn't hold my breath for that.
And what do you have your eye on mostly this week?
Well, I think that... I think the military aid and additional sanctions are what we need to do in terms of supporting Ukraine. And the other thing is, I think on the military front, it's just important to see where Russia is moving, what their actions are, because clearly their words are not very meaningful at this point.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Yoshiko Herrera, a political scientist and professor at UW-Madison. She joined us for a look at the latest news in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, what it could take to end that invasion, and what to watch for in the weeks to come.